Hello and welcome to The Label Sessions Presents, the podcast built to connect innovators around the world to what they need to know right now. I'm Nick Sherrod, one of the founders of Label Sessions, and this week we are welcoming two new leaders to our roster. We're also going to go through a whole range of different topics, but I should stop as well to say I'm also joined by content producer Josh Nixon. So Josh, hello and welcome.
Hello, pleasure to be here as always.
So this week, we're going to be talking through how we generate more spin-outs from universities. We're going to be talking through what we can learn about the future of AI from some of the misuses of it. We're also going to be talking around how we will buy cars in the future, or how we might buy cars in the future, and also ask whether it's a good time for brands to be picking enemies again. But first of all, let's introduce the label mates who we'll be talking through all of this with today. And I'm going to start with Tammy Madsen. So Tammy is a professor, an author, and an advisor working out of the Academy of Leadership in Santa Clara University, among other places, which is already quite a diverse introduction, but there's a lot more, even more, to Tammy's story and to the kind of background that sits behind that. So she helps businesses and industries rethink how they collaborate, grow, and stay ahead in rapidly evolving markets. And her work spans corporate innovation and M&A, leadership development, but all with a focus on navigating disruption and building adaptable organizations in a host of different ways. So Tammy, what are you excited about in innovation or in the world of work right now?
I think that what was really top of mind is AI. So, and I think it's hard to go through a day without thinking about sort of, well, how do we use this tool? How do we think about it going further? And I think one of the challenges for organizations is that this adoption gap is growing. And you know, if companies are waiting for what's going to be the dominant design or what's the next version of this technology that I should hold out for, it might be too late, because this is not a technology problem. It's an organizational challenge. Right? The technology is a tool that sort of can be used. Certainly, there's a lot of work in that space. Rehan can sort of fill us in on that background. But I think it's really changed. It will change the way we work, right? And it's not something that's going to stop. It's going to continue to go. A colleague of mine says, you know, it's moving at a triple exponential rate in terms of its development. And we know that artificial general intelligence is coming relatively soon, or hopefully soon. Prediction engines suggest relatively soon. So, since it is changing the way we work, sort of how do we adapt to it in organizations? What kinds of actions should be taken? And, you know, sort of where do we invest our resources? How do we decide what to do? And then how long, you know, I think the challenge for many organizations is they want to see a quick uptake on value creation and value capture. And that's sort of something that's going to take a little, it might take a little while. And if you think about it being not just at the interface, let's say between the customer or sort of the slow hanging fruit pieces, it's really sort of the back end, all the workflows of the organization. How do we insert AI agents into those workflows? Those kinds of things. So really about how do you move from sort of kind of tactical responses to strategic use? How do we move from transactional to transformational use? I think that is sort of really at the forefront. And, you know, while we know this technology, Gen AI tokens are declining in cost, there's a bunch of other costs associated with engaging with this technology, right? So it's not inexpensive. It's a big investment, but it's not going away, right? Yeah. It will be with us. We'll be working side. We'll all have our own AI agents going forward, I think.
It's really interesting that adoption. Yeah, it's interesting that adoption gap here, because it's one of the areas where most companies, I think, do want to get involved. But the question of how is somehow where some of the gaps currently are, perhaps.
There's a fear of missing out and a fear of getting in. Yeah. Right? Both of those are sort of happening. And it's, you know, I think that we're seeing some universities are training their graduate students, for instance. Each of them will have a couple of agents working with them. So as those start to populate the workforce, now we'll start to think about, well, our workflows. But I think a big part of it is just take a simple workflow and figure out where does the AI agent sit in there? How does it work and collaborate with the human to accelerate or make that workflow task more effective, better, faster?
Rehan, it would be great to get your take, I guess, across a range of so many different things. But what are you most excited about right now in your area of work?
Yeah, so right now, what inspires me most is the potential of edge AI. Now, what I really meant by basically edge AI, it means that in general, the most of the artificial intelligence, the computation is happening on the cloud. But when we talk about Edge AI, it means that all the computation is happening on your device. Now, it really opens up a lot of possibilities. Like, as an example, we all know the concept of Internet of Things, which means that most of the devices are now connected with the basically internet. And now having intelligence on them will mean that they are not only connected with the internet, but they are also intelligent and smart enough. And there are a lot of areas. So as an example, if we talk about healthcare, we talk about advanced remote farming, industrial automation, supply chain management. So a lot of applications.
Let's move into the first topic then. So in particular, this is not a UK podcast, but I'm going to speak from a UK perspective. One of the things that's been a big story here over the last week in the world of innovation has been Universities UK. So the trade body saying that this country risks becoming an incubator nation on the basis that so many of the spin-offs that do occur from our universities end up driving value for other places, or the companies move on quite quickly. But that opens up a question which comes up a lot in the world of label sessions, partly from people who are involved with universities, partly from business leaders working out how they can access knowledge in universities better. But the question is really this: how can we get more spin-outs and more successful companies coming from universities or taking the IP from universities and starting to take that out into the world? So you're both quite close to this in different aspects, I guess. So what are some of the key things you have in mind for what's gonna drive more successful spin-outs? Tani, maybe if I come to you first on that one, what sure. are some of the front of mind things you have on that topic?
I think about the kind of conditions that lead to a really healthy innovation ecosystem or entrepreneurial cluster, if you will. And we know many of these have existed around the world. I'm in Silicon Valley, so it tends to be sort of a hallmark or model that has been attempted to be replicated. And I think the challenge is that it takes some time to sort of for this whole dynamic to unfold and to be patient around when it unfolds. But it's more that, you know, we think about kind of a diverse set of network ties. We think about a healthy labor pool, technology access, academic ties, government support, venture capital funding or funding models within that, but also an open mindset. And so So we can sort of try to set these things up and let them evolve, but there's a sort of inorganic element there's an organic element that sort of occurs within this space that needs to sort of get accelerated for this kind of increasing returns to happen, for some kind of economies agglomeration to occur. We think about the university space, and lots of accelerators or incubators within universities for startups, do we just kind of, here's some resources, here's some space, fly be free? Or do we say, we're going to also provide you with some guidance, right? We have some mentors. We're going to sort of embed you in a network. Now, once you're there, you have to sort of continue to grow that network. But what types of guidance are we providing sort of these startups to help them become sort of these really great organizations? And of course, they start out with some are going to be designed to be acquired, right? And others will be like, we want to be the next big thing. We want to be the next big Google, Apple, whoever it is, right? So they require, those types of organizations require different types of guidance. And so what can we do as a university in university context to help manage that growth? And then if they're spinning out, we want them to sort of kind of establish that organization within the community in which that university is present or within the city itself or in the country. Then how do we also provide bridges to that process, right? What are some things that firms can do or organizations can do to help sort of the companies move forward in that direction, or governments can do? Because funding is helpful, but it's all these tacit underlying intangibles that actually are really critical, and they're very difficult to quantify, and they're very difficult to say, we're just going to put this much in and we'll see how long it goes, and then we'll move it all out. And so you have to get the system moving in this positive feedback loop, but it does require a number of different elements to make that healthy. And part of it might be the labor pool. Part of it might be venture capital funding through multiple tiers. Is that available?
Yeah. So, it's interesting though, Tami, because I think lots of the rest of the world, when they look to Silicon Valley in particular, but America in general, are very envious of the investment pool of the kind of the kind of venture capital community that's there. But you're actually calling out lots of other things that you think are quite important to what makes it work in your setting. So things like labor, things like the kind of tacit things. So it's interesting. What are some of the things that are front of mind that you think make the kind of American system on this so successful?
Well, I think this kind of Silicon Valley model has been tried to be replicated in other states as well. So not as successfully. I think this particular model, you know, has foundings in interrelationships between universities, the emergence of venture capital, engineering, talent, the sort of foundations of it started in that space, right? But I think one of the unobservables is the willingness of individuals just to share knowledge, period. Right. And we tend to think about our organizations as we created this knowledge. We're going to protect it. We're going to sort of keep it to ourselves. It's ours. It's our crown jewel. But in fact, there's a lot of interaction that occurs that, you know, even if you're just at the, you know, sort of going to work out or you're going to sort of the store, you're going to get coffee. There tends to be sort of interactions that occur. And it sounds odd, but they do happen. Right. Someone reaches out and said, well, let's just have a chat. OK, we'll have a chat, sort of come back. I thought about this idea. So you also have this notion of not just knowledge from the same kind of localized knowledge base and specialized space, but distant knowledge, right? You're connecting pieces of information. Oh, well, did you hear about that guy over there? They've created this new tool, and oh, maybe we could use this in a different way in our space to solve a problem that we have. So I think those kinds of things occur. But I think the other piece is that this guidance that sort of there's a lot been written about how to start a company. We can all sort of read those things. There's entrepreneurship classes. But you know, when you have these, when are you pivoting? When do you make a big shift in the organization? So you're now got this founding team of 10. So how do we manage that shift? How do we set up a healthy organization? Now all of a sudden we're growing a lot. What's the next step that we need to take? So some additional guidance from the mentors about how to move that forward. And I think some VCs will provide that type of guidance, but that guidance can come from executives. It can come from managers that have actually done that kind of work before. It doesn't have to come from the funding group. And some of them won't, right? They're going to be standoffish, more hands-off type models. I think those pieces are really important for the roadmap for any startup.
Yeah, that's a really interesting piece. Rahan, I'm interested in your take on this, because edge AI is a classic kind of area where people, policymakers would say this is a great example of an area where spin-outs should happen and could happen. What are some of the things that you see working? And what are some of the key elements that you think people should have in mind if they want more of them to work?
So considering edge AI, it's a very promising area. The expected global market is around $130 billion by 2030. The big question which we need to ask always is that not every kind of artificial intelligence can move to the basically edge, right? Because most of the AI algorithms, they are quite computationally expensive. And you cannot really port them on smaller devices, right? So what it really means is that whoever wants to open up a startup, they really need to dig out that what is the main benefit of moving that particular algorithm to the device. As an example, let's talk about these home automation devices. So we have a lot of home automation devices these days, right? And mostly these are connected. We can control them via basically internet, right? Now, which is okay. Now, but it also makes a lot of things vulnerable. Like as an example, if anyone hacks onto your basically system, you can switch on off devices. Even a small hack can cause a lot of damage. And in general, we feel excited when we know that, okay, I can say that, hello, Alexa, you know, open up my air fryer and so on. But we do not really need to inform Amazon or Google what we are really cooking in the air fryer, right? So one big challenge that basically comes is about confidentiality, about the confidentiality of the basically data. And the ideally, all those kind of applications where confidentiality is very important, those are ideally basically suited for basically edge AI, right?
Okay. So, and it's interesting. So in terms of that whole area, there's so many things to think through there. Do you feel that there's the opportunity for people to create companies in those spaces in different parts of the world? Or do you think that's still going to be an area where you're going to have to be, well, the best options to try and take that IP into a big company somewhere? Do you think there's an opportunity in different parts of the world to create companies?
I would say that there is actually a lot more options or a lot more opportunity to work in this area while being even in a developing state. And the reason is that most of the other kind of applications, as an example, large language models like ChatGPT and all those kind of algorithms, they require a lot of computational effort, right? They also require a lot of, we can say, compute investment. And that is a very common problem these days, okay? And so considering that, it is much more affordable to open a startup related to, you can say, these small devices. They do require a lot of specific expertise, which one needs. But yeah, it's much more affordable to open a startup in this area, I would say.
Let's move on to the next one, actually, there. Because one of the things, actually, Tammy, you talked before about adoption gap. Well, one of the things that sometimes is driving the adoption gap in AI is fear of some of the misuses of AI or some of the even criminal uses of AI that are becoming higher profile, or at least that we're now kind of seeing in practice. So over the last week, we saw gangs using AI to blackmail people. We also saw ChatGPT being sued. We haven't seen the outcome of it yet, but we've seen people take legal action against ChatGPT around hallucinations and its ability to defame people, therefore. And that does mean that leaders we speak to are quite often getting more risks flagged to them currently in terms of the deployment of AI within enterprise. So do we think these, you know, these news stories are just stories that are kind of noise and we should focus elsewhere? Or do they show us something important around what our future strategy should be around AI in particular?
I think it's a huge issue. I think that, you know, I think in Europe, there's been very careful development of an AI policy. And in the US, I think we've just seen removals around an AI policy that was put in by the last administration, which is not unusual. We see these turnarounds of policies, et cetera. But that was all, it was a very loose policy, and it was slightly framed around safety, trust. And so I think if we have to think about sort of who should be responsible. And so companies need to think about the risks and limitations. And I heard an example a couple of weeks ago, which was that I think it's Apple Card, right? Which is by Goldman Sachs. And they had, I guess, sort of they were giving, it was AI. They had an AI model in the background. Same household, same income level, women receive less credit from this. And so when they said, well, no, our model doesn't have any gender in it. No, but it has hundreds of factors that might correlate with gender. So this sort of raises a question in the background, like, well, as you're an organization, what's the data you're using? How are you using it? What are the unintended consequences that might occur? And so thinking really carefully through what the risks are, but it also suggests that we need that kind of understanding within organizations, right? And many of us are at a different level in terms of understanding, okay, here's how the tool might work, but we get down into the details of the data itself and the training data and sort of how we're managing that training data and layering on top of that. Now we're going to be adding synthetic data because we're running out of training data. Companies are already using that space, that content. So how do we, if we're creating synthetic data, how do we create it so that it's not going to lead to these kinds of biases? And so I think every organization will need to think carefully about how do we use it responsibly? What policies do we put in place to sort of guarantees to our customers about what we're doing, what kinds of actions we're taking, and what are the guardrails? I think another piece of this is what are the guardrails around regulatory capture, right? So that if organizations are trying to establish themselves to sort of say, look, we want to carve out this entire space, we want to protect ourselves, well, is that always best for the consumer and for other organizations in their use? So those are some starting points, I think, to think about.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think also you talked before about the whole sort of tech stack of AI from a startup perspective, but it's interesting as well from an enterprise perspective, because one of the things we see already starting to sort of, issues to this causes some risk flags is the sort of misalignment currently between regulation of cloud infrastructure in Europe and in the US. And that's going to drive a lot of choices around AI if we're not careful, if somehow those two regulatory systems don't find a way to align themselves or find some way of making that link work. Raham, what do you think when you look at some of these things? Do you think like, hey, these scary use cases are just to be expected, or do you think there's things there that are really important for understanding the future of AI?
Actually, the problem is not the problem, but what's happening is I think the pace of advancements in AI is amazing, right? And it is exponentially increasing as well. I would believe that we are not ready for this kind of transformation as of now. So as an example, even people living in remote villages of developing country would be listening to ChatGPT's audio in their own language, right? And it's factually correct. Okay, right. So as an example, now. It's basically, it is a language model. Hopefully it will be giving you the right information, but it is not necessarily the correct information, right? So what I want to say is that the pace of development of AI, it has basically outpaced the public awareness and the regularity readiness. So yeah.
Yes, it's interesting too as well. So I think one of the other regulations people don't always talk about in conjunction with AI, but is really important, is consumer protection in Europe and in America, which is for very good reasons, but is also going to be quite a big blocker to deploying a lot of these AI tools in customer-facing scenarios, because the consequences and the costs of some of these hallucinations are much higher in certain parts of the world than they are. It's interesting. We always have a kind of running theme, I think, in Label Sessions. So quite often you can learn a lot about the future of a technology by looking at some of the use cases in the world of vice and crime. Quite often that's an early adopter group to learn from, I think, in terms of how these things can be used. Let us go back to legal things, though, as in like the actual legal economy rather than the dark economy. And let's talk a little bit about how might we buy cars in the future. And now there's a story that's doing the rounds that's definitely driving change, but also some innovation in the financial services world and the fintech world in Europe and in the UK, which is driven by the fact that banks and car finance companies are currently facing some quite big bills to make good on some past offences, where there's a feeling now that consumers didn't really understand the financial arrangements that they were getting into. And certainly car finance as an area, a bit like car dealerships, is not an area that has the best reputation globally already. There's an old saying that leaders should never waste a good crisis. It certainly seems that there's a crisis moment or a moment of change in car finance and the kind of car industry currently more broadly. So is now the worst time or the best time for it to be an innovator in car finance? And if you are an ambitious leader in this kind of space, what kind of things might you be looking at for where the future of the industry might be? Raham, maybe just pick up on that. What kind of things do you think you might be looking at if you're an ambitious leader in this space?
The main problem, like the news article which you were just referring to, I think one of the main problem is about transparency. That people aren't really knowing what are the fine lines behind every contract, right? And obviously that is some place where transparency and digitalization can help.
It's interesting, Tammy, I think, in terms of one of the sort of moments we're at, because there's lots of regulation coming through around consumer protection and finance, but equally, I think, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, you saw you can now do Klarna, spread your payments on DoorDash. So essentially, there's kind of two things going on. Where on one stage, more regulation, the other side, chaos in terms of the kind of credit that people are getting into. But more positively, where would you be looking if you were a kind of ambitious, innovative leader in this kind of space right now?
I think we're seeing different kinds of ownership models starting to emerge. right? Subscription models, flexible ownership models. And I think actually Porsche might have a model where you can sort of, you purchase some, you don't, it's not a purchase, maybe it's a leasing model, but you can get a different kind of car. You can switch out the vehicle on a monthly basis or something like this. But I think that as we continue to see an increase in ride sharing, an increase in, you know, autonomous vehicles, we have Waymo in the city that's sort of, you know, testing that out. As that technology becomes more robust and we begin to trust it more, then these alternatives about subscription services actually might be a model where individuals are going to get a better understanding or be closer to what their needs are, right? So it might take a sort of shifting back. Yeah. What's the persona, the average persona? What's the average customer now? How do they use these other tools? Or if they're not using them, then we have more of a traditional model. But being able to switch out vehicles, covering subscription models on, you know, pay-as-you-go type of insurance, which is has been around for a little bit now, right? And the insurance industry itself is seems like it's ready for a little bit of a transformation. It's just me, right? And things, you know, we had all the fires in Los Angeles, and immediately State Farm, one of the largest insurance companies, were like, okay, rates are going to increase 25%. Right? Okay, but all these folks have been paying in for quite a number of years, so what's happening here, right? So, but I think, so that's one piece. I think the transparency piece that Rohan mentioned is a really critical one. Simplicity is another piece. Maybe we can think about data-driven personalization in terms of how you set up the model for each individual coming in. And as he mentioned, it can, you know, what about digital models? How many of us want to go to a dealership? No one wants to have that experience. And so what's a way around that? And I think you can, you know, there are some startups that have this model in place where you can buy a vehicle, it just shows up to your house. You have to get comfortable with doing that whole digital experience. And not our entire audience isn't fully there yet, right? There's adopters in certain stages, but, you know, maybe, you know, some of our great uncles or aunts are sort of not as comfortable in that space yet. So, but I think it's a natural evolution for the space. But thinking very carefully, how do we think about the model completely differently, the sales process itself, in fact? And then maybe on the finance side, well, if we're moving into this EV space, it's sort of trying to grow the EV space more. Do we have sustainability focused financing? Do we embed kind of carbon credits? Do we sort of put some other kind of features in there? Do we have separate financing that addresses EV depreciation concerns? Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting space there, because also a lot of the times all around the world, we see the data that the time you first buy an EV and you start charging a car at home is also the first time you start thinking about solar panels if you don't have them at home. There's interesting these kind of moments in the journeys where you think actually there's quite a different proposition you could launch in this kind of space, realizing where customers actually are once you break out of the kind of habit of dealerships and that whole
thing. Yeah, in California, there's a policy intended by 2035 that all new vehicles purchased in California are to be electric vehicles or renewable energy-based vehicles. Well, our grid is antiquated. So as everybody comes home at night and starts to plug in, there's some challenges that are sort of coming forward on the horizon.
Yeah, core infrastructure. Really interesting. Let's just move into our final question, which is a slightly more brand focused one, but it's interesting because it cuts across all kinds of industries just now. And it's that brands are choosing enemies again. And this could be a fad or it could be more of a strategic play, but there are kind of a new kind or a new breed of challenger brand that's emerging that are not quite Patagonia style in terms of having a completely clear ethical position as such. But they're also not the kind of BrewDog, move fast and break things type disruptor either. They are certainly making clear who their enemies are. So we saw Blue Sky selling t-shirts mocking Mark Zuckerberg last week and making more money through that than they were through selling the custom domains, which is supposed to be the core product. Kia in Scandinavia, I've got ads where their cars have a sticker plastered on them saying, I bought this after Elon went crazy. Is this a key play for brands just now, or is this a trap that it could be too easy for them to fall into? Tell me, maybe get your review on this. Do you think brands choosing enemies again, is this a fad or is it a bit of a trap?
I think that we've become a very contentious society where there's like leaders fighting divides, right, under whether it's under false pretenses or not. But that we're in an environment, and that environment really sort of has this kind of negative imprint, right? The organization's practices, what we're willing to do, what we're not willing to do. And I think we're seeing in the social environment, audiences gravitate towards very bold, edgy kinds of advertising and marketing. So something goes viral. A viral marketing is its replacement for that sort of traditional. Does it have more impact? Or were we able to catch sort of more attention with this by creating this kind of tension, if you will? And so maybe a little bit is driven by that. The social media tends to reward that kind of boldness, right? So that might be a little bit. And then analytics are easy and fast to tap the pulse of the customer. So sort of they can be used to sort of really say, you know, get a really quick gauge on, is this ad working? Is it not working? So all of that is working in our favor. But we've had, you know, like we've had sort of some battles in the past, just not quite as aggressive as lately. And I think as more, you know, any space where there's tensions emerging, we're going to see these kinds of actions. But you know, the idea that Blue Sky is creating t-shirts in this space is really amusing. It's also become easier to do some of these types of things than it was, you know, 30 years ago. So it's, you know, what's the CEO's position? How do they feel about this kind of environment? Is it, well, if we get some, if the viral marketing is going to boost us 1% in sales, are we going to sort of just focus on the sales and that's it? We're not going to focus on, you know, potentially ethics or integrity or, right? So I think leaders will be making different kinds of choices.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think definitely is also interesting that thing of short term, it's quite easy to get lots of engagement maybe around this kind of quite angry or kind of adversarial marketing tactic, but whether you can build it over time and also whether things play the same way in different parts of the world or when played back in 6 months' time when something else has happened, that's the kind of challenge, I guess, from a
brand perspective.
We're
seeing a lot of Tesla vehicles, their emblems being replaced with other vehicle companies' emblems these days. And we sort of know what that's in response to. And so some of these things are sort of like some events occurred and everybody's responding to that versus sort of, I think you're right. Is it the long term? Will that be the viable model going forward? Or will we hopefully get back to, you know, oh, just Pepsi or Coke?
Yeah, exactly. And also has to be said, sales-wise, Tesla looks like a brand that's taken a bashing because of this kind of stuff. Share price-wise, not at all. Well, a little bit, but like in terms of maybe it's still, look at their overall valuation, it's still not a bad story compared to the rest of the automotive sector. So it's an interesting one that's there. So, Rahan, it's on this last question here. So brands are choosing enemies again. Do you reckon this is a fad or is actually something bigger for the future?
Nothing bigger. I would believe that it won't be a long-term it shouldn't be the long-term basically strategy because they are targeting individuals, not the brands, which might not work in the longer run because I would say that personalities do not stay forever, but brands do, right? So yeah, it shouldn't be the way to go, I would say.
Yeah. Or maybe you're sounding as well, as less it's the trap, it's more that it's just not that interesting in the rest of the world as well. That's maybe the other take.
unless you're Ryanair, where your entire customer base is your enemy. So.
Well, that is a very particular. I'm also not sure that would work in another parts of the world as well. So I don't know if everyone knows this, but we have in the UK and Europe, we have Ryanair, who is a brand that essentially abuses their customers on social media, but customers seem to like it. So like, this is maybe
actually, like, even if you consider it, all these basically famous personalities, they have a lot of following in both ways, right? So if you make their half of the fans happier, and then they're always haters of that particular personality as well. So you are either targeting the haters or the, you know, basically, you know, followers. So I think a better way, and I would believe that effectively you are dividing your own, you can say, customer base as well, which might not be a good thing in the longer run. But yes, I also believe that, you know, for a very quick kind of marketing, you can do it as well, but not in the longer run.
Yeah, it's maybe also interesting because of the way the social media has changed. It's almost like you're going to get this kind of pull within your marketing team now, because everyone's in their own boxes now. So in terms of typically X is going to be your audience there is going to be much more pro one side of a debate. Blue Sky, your audience is going to be that. It's an interesting thing for a marketing director to work through, which is almost like if you organize your teams by channel, then you're always going to have different political messages coming to you at the marketing table in terms of what's getting resonance. Interesting. So some fantastic topics that have gone through there, that have gone through this. We try not to make the Label Session Presents podcast a purely business or all business chat. So we also give people a chance to call out any cultural picks from the last week or creative picks from the last week, which could be the best music, film, TV, design or books that you found over the last week. Does anyone have any particular picks they want to call out? Maybe Rehan, did you spot anything good this week?
I was just reading one book. It's an old one, though. It's 1984 by George Orwell.
It's
actually very interesting in a way if you connect it with how many of the companies are owning our data, right? So actually they can't control anything. Like, they can wipe out our memories. They can add up actually new memories which we haven't really gone through. Okay, isn't it? So I would say that if you read that novel with that kind of perspective, it might give it a completely different, you know, you can say perception. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Big Brother is no longer a state, it's a company, it's a tech platform.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Tammy, how about yourself? Did you pick up anything good this week?
I don't know if this is just this week, but I have on my reading list Super Agency by Reid Hoffman and Greg Beato. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the second name correctly. And then on the podcast front, which is a very different space, I'm looking for any kind of comedy these days because there's been a lot of unrest in the US, and so Amy Poehler has a new podcast out, so I sort of starting to listen to that, I tend to listen to The Hard Fork and then The Provocateurs, and a colleague has a new podcast out which is Private Innovation Public Interest, and so I'm sort of trying to catch up on those kinds of things.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, so we'll put that in the notes so you can get the full credit for having plugged it during the recording. And Josh, normally you have some tips out there for your cultural picks of the week as well. What are your best finds this week?
So I'm catching up. So I watched The Brutalist, finally. Won the big Oscars winners. And it was fantastic. But I was watching it through the lens of it being caught in its own AI controversy of Adrian Brody, the lead actor, is Hungarian in the film. And then I didn't realize that they used an AI voice model or an actual Hungarian native speaker. And then applied that to his voice is the gist that I'm gathering. I might be wrong on that, but I just thought it was really interesting in terms of like how AI is used in film. I know we're talking about it a little bit in terms of how it's applied to crime, but how it's used in arts is equally as fascinating to me. And it's something that I wouldn't even particularly realize until I read the article, because there's been a couple of uses of it in the past in films that I've seen. Like last year, there's a film called Late Night with the Devil where they used AI generated artwork, which was quite obvious, but for small little tweaks and changes like that, it's really fascinating, because I don't know if I necessarily have a problem with it, but I also understand people that do. It's kind of, I don't know where, I'm kind of sitting on the fence with it, really. So,
yeah.
Film is fantastic, so that's all, I guess that's all that matters at the end.
Interesting. It's maybe a sign of the times as well that we didn't actually theme every question around AI as such, but it came up in every topic. It's just the sort of thing we're driving the way we make films, the way we tell stories, the way we buy cars. It's an interesting area. Great. So let's wrap up there. There's so many fascinating topics as we go through the podcast this week. If you want to get access to Label Sessions, then do reach out to us on all the different social platforms that we're on. I think we are on just about all of them, of all different political persuasions in all different parts of the world. And if you want to find out more about asking Label Sessions to take on your challenges, mentor your leaders, or train your AI, head to labelsessions.com. But for now, that's it from us. Goodbye.